Well, Shabbat Shalom.
Shabbat Shalom.
We're here.
Yes.
Hopefully, hopefully the stream is working. There's no internet here yet. August 1st. Using my phone, so I'm not sure what the resolution's going to be, but at least it's going. And for those of you online, you can see we're at the rental now, and we're getting somewhat settled in, I think. Sherilyn's done a great job of making it a home, as she always does, and I think we're able to find at least the most important things. So we begin, I guess, the next phase. Now, next week, they're supposed to start dirt work, and we'll get started on the new place. If you look at that screen online now, they've got a pretty large screen and a little bitty me, which I really like. I really like that. Focus on the word, not so much on me. It's a good thing. So, with that in mind, let's dive in, shall we? Everybody ready? Let's do it. It's been a rough week, but thankfully I already had quite a few notes on this, so I'm going to kind of run through them, and then, as always, we'll just circle up. All right. Last time was chapter 1 of Leviticus, and we looked at the sacrificial ritual called Olah in Hebrew, if you remember, O-L-A-H, Olah. What we typically call the burnt offering, we learned, was more like a sinned offering, or a kind of a lifting up offering. There's chimes outside that door. I've opened it 5 times. We're going to have to move them. I keep thinking somebody's there. But anyway, the Olah from last time was more of, we call it the burnt offering, but it's more of an ascension offering, or a lifted up offering, if you'll recall. Just like incense ascends to the throne, or is lifted up to the throne. Okay. We saw that this offering concerned the burning up of animals, you know, bulls and sheep and birds, and that burning up was to be complete. Nothing was to remain. Today, as we go to chapter 2, Yehovah is describing a second type of offering, and it's too going to be kind of a burnt offering. It's going to be burned up in that sense. The same way on the brazen altar. But this sacrifice is not of animal life, but of plant life, and specifically of grain, and even more specifically, something called semolina. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that right. That's how it's spelled. And it's basically the very best part of the grain. You know, Yehovah always desires the very best from us. Now, that's how I kind of look at it. But there could be more to it than that. There probably needs to be a study of what this is. I don't know. Because as we go through these various sacrifices, it should not be lost on you that there is probably more to many phases of this than what we understand. You know, I was thinking about this, and I've said it many times that God's ways, His plans, very simple, right? I mean, in that sense, you can describe the overall umbrella of God's plan very simply. But as you get deeper, it gets more complicated. Well, and maybe not complicated, that's not maybe the right word. Richer. Yeah, richer. It gets richer the deeper that you get. And it really is a great travesty perpetrated by a church that is very eager many times to dumb down everything for the layperson. And we get some of these sort of thoughts that, like, you know, sin is a sin, okay? That God doesn't classify them or grades them. that essentially stealing a candy bar is no different than robbing a bank. And it's just simply not true in God's eyes. We've talked about that, how God divides and he separates and he does these things. That maybe, for instance, the same sacrifice applies for both. Well, yeah, that's true. But the consequences are not the same, are they? No. So I can't help but think that there's so much more to many of these little things that could show us further the depth of God's mind, how he sees justice and other things that are embedded in these offerings. So never would I suggest that my comments are in any way exhaustive. That's why, you know, we circle up. We want to talk about these things. I can only share what the Spirit, you know, shows me or I discover through that direction from other people and then are able to communicate. So let's read chapter 2. Well, we're going to start with verse 1. When anyone offers a grain offering to the Lord, his offering shall be a fine flour. We'll talk about that. And he shall pour oil on it and put frankincense on it. He shall bring it to Aaron's sons, the priests, one of whom shall take from it his handful of fine flour. We're going to break all this down. And oil with all the frankincense, and the priest shall burn it as a memorial on the altar, an offering made by fire, a sweet, many translations say fragrant, sweet aroma to the Lord. The rest of the grain offering shall be Aaron's and his sons. It is most holy, kadesh, of the offerings to the Lord made by fire. And if you bring an offering, a grain offering baked in the oven, it shall be unleavened cakes of fine flour mixed with oil, or unleavened wafers anointed with oil. So one way the oil is mixed in the dough, the other way we're going to cover that, it's put on top. But if your offering is a grain offering baked in a pan, it shall be a fine flour, unleavened, mixed with oil. You shall break it in pieces and pour oil on it. It is a grain offering. If your offering is a grain offering baked in a covered pan, it shall be made of fine flour with oil. You shall bring the grain offering that is made of these things to the Lord, and when it is presented to the priest, he shall bring it to the altar. Then the priest shall take it from the grain offering, a memorial portion, this is that handful, and burn it on the altar. It is an offering made by fire, a sweet, fragrant aroma to the Lord. And what is left of the grain offering shall be Aaron's and his sons. It is most holy of the offerings to the Lord made by fire. No grain offering which you bring to the Lord shall be made with leaven, for you shall burn no leaven, nor any honey. I'm going to cover this. In any offering to the Lord made by fire. As for the offering of the first fruits, you shall offer them to the Lord, but they shall not be burned on the altar for a sweet aroma. And every offering of your grain offering you shall season with salt. That's interesting. And you shall not allow the salt of the covenant. I'm going to talk about that phrase. Of your God to be lacking from your grain offering. With all your offerings you shall offer salt. If you offer a grain offering of your first fruits of the Lord, you shall offer for the grain offering of your first fruits green heads of grain, roasted on the fire, grain beaten from full heads. This is different from the semolina. And you shall put oil on it and lay frankincense on it. It is a grain offering. Then the priest shall burn the memorial portion, part of its beaten grain and part of its oil, with all of the frankincense as an offering made by fire to the Lord. So we're going to break some of this down, and I think I mentioned last week that olah, the burnt offering of an animal, was often done in conjunction with other types of offerings. In fact, the daily burnt offering at the tabernacle, as far as the records can tell us, was always followed by this grain offering. They were always done in pairs. They were always done together. And I think the reason will become clear as we look at this more closely. Now, just as Olah is the specific Hebrew name for the burnt offering of an animal that we talked about in chapter 1, the name for the specific name for this offering is called Minka. And I don't know if I'm pronouncing it right. Just bear with me. M-I-N-C-H-A-H. So we have the Olah last time, and now we have the Minka. So many times the Bible will translate this into meal, and call it a meal offering. And that is technically a correct translation. It just doesn't fit very well with how we use the word, okay? When we say meal, what do you think of? Breakfast, lunch, and dinner, okay? But it wasn't that long ago when you said meal that it meant a finely ground grain, like cornmeal, okay? So meal is correct. It's just, like I say, just not kind of the way that we normally think about it. So that's simple enough, but more confusing is in some Bible translations, they've used the word meat, and they call it a meat offering. The King James Version does that. I can't find out precisely why. Now, I have some things to say about that. But I think maybe the reason has to do with a conflict, a translation problem in the story of Cain and Abel. And I'll get to that in a minute. But just know that if you see meat offering in your Bible, just do yourself a favor and scratch it out and just write in grain, because meal might confuse you too. It's a grain offering. Meat is just plain inaccurate. I mean, as far as the word meat means to us in the modern world. So the minka is an offering of the choicest part of the grain, the semolina, which is then ground into a meal, okay? So then they take the meal and they add that oil in that we read about, and we get this dough. And it's this dough that then is burned on the altar. And we read over and over again that it's fine flour. You see that a lot. We read it several times. Fine flour. That's really not interpreted correctly either, the way we've heard it in so many messages. It's not flour that has just been sifted so much that it's just really fine. You know, that's not what it is. Nor is it basically, okay, we're going to grind up all the flour and we're going to pick the best flour. No, it's none of those things. It is the semolina. It is that best part. It's the finest part of the grain, then beat into a meal. So that is the fine flour, is the semolina. Okay, so to this thing with Cain and Abel. The word minka, you've heard me say that there's a law of first usage in a word. We lean towards that. That's what's confusing about minka, because the word was used in Genesis 4 in talking about this sacrifice that Cain brought and Abel brought. Here's the reference. I'm not going to read it. But you'll remember the acceptable minka was Abel's sacrifice, and it was an animal. It was a minka sacrifice of an animal. The unacceptable sacrifice of Cain's was also a plant life. It was probably a grain offering. It was minka as well. So in both cases, the offering was referred to as minka. So the first usage of the word really is sacrifice, right? Because they were both sacrifices, just not a specific kind. It wasn't until later that minka became synonymous then with the grain offering, and Olah for the animal. So it was, it's really kind of ironic though, and it's kind of why I think that it confused the translators, because the minka that was acceptable in God's in eyes in Genesis was an animal, but then was later referred to as olah. But God refused the minka of grain given by Cain. So I think that's what threw the King James translators off track. So what they did is they said, okay, well, the minka first in Genesis was to an animal and it was acceptable, and that was meat. So when they got to Leviticus, that's why they called it a meat this offering a meat offering. So that's my guess. That's what I think happened. But at any rate, over the period of a couple thousand years then, by the time we get to Leviticus, we see that the word minka was used to have nothing to do with meat, only with the grain offering. In fact, that is the specific name that is used for the grain offering. You know, the great sages, some of them really wrote that the meaning and the purpose of the grain offering had less to do with what was offered and more to do with the purpose that it was offered. And so that's really what we want to focus on. It's not so much about it being grain as it was meant to be a tribute, okay, or a gift to God. So in both of the first two types of sacrifices that we've looked at so far, the olah and now the minka, part of their basic essence is that they are gifts to God, but they are required gifts, which is kind of the nature of a tribute. So when we think about the word tribute, we think about historically a long line of conquered people placing gifts of appeasement to a conquering king, right? That's a tribute. It's probably the closest analogy we've got to what we are dealing with here in Leviticus with these sacrifices. So another little interesting aspect of the minka is that it eventually came to be a word that reference the late afternoon or early evening, because that's when the sacrifice was normally given. So it kind of doubled in that meaning. So when you read some of the ancient works and commentaries, you'll find that the late afternoon prayers were often called the minka prayers or the time of minka, meaning that it was time for those prayers, so it became synonymous. One thing that's different, I don't know if you noticed this when we read the passage, but the grain offering, there was only a small amount of that was actually offered on the altar, right? The rest of it was used as food. But the first one, everything went. This was just this. The mixture was made up, and you saw it could be done in various ways. It could be cooked or uncooked, whatever. Yehovah even stated that if it was cooked, that it could be baked in an oven, it could be baked on a griddle or cooked in a pan, closed or open, right? So I read that when the dough was baked in an oven, it could be accomplished in a couple of ways, right, with a couple of different outcomes. Look here at verse 4. I'm not going to read it again. But we see that the oil could be added to the dough, and this would produce a cake, right? Now, that cake, or that bread, if you will, that's called challah. You ever heard of challah bread? That's where that comes from. The Jews break challah bread on Friday night when this, you know, their Sabbath meal. That's where the name of that bread came from. The other outcome for the dough baked in an oven is called rakik, R-A-K-I-K. And these are thin wafers. And so after you bake the rakik, then you take the oil. Remember it said to anoint it with oil? So you either put it in there and bake it and you get the challah, or you make the wafers and you take the oil and you anoint the wafers with the oil. Okay, in both cases though, we see that it's unleavened bread because the dough has to be unleavened. Understand, nothing with leaven ever goes on the brazen altar. And I'm gonna tell you why here in a minute. We don't want to also overlook that back in verse 2, God commands that frankincense is to be added to the dough. Now, frankincense was very expensive, and it was used to create a pleasing odor, you know, a fragrant aroma, right? Incense burning was commonplace in Israel and in all the other nations around them. Why? Because they were agricultural. They were doing a lot of farming. They were around a lot of animal dung. They didn't bathe every day, take a shower every day, and use their Dial soap, right? So incense was a big thing, and also fragrant oils were a big thing to mask the odors. Okay. Why, though, would the frankincense be added to the dough? Now, we ask that question and we don't find the answer in the Bible. And the reason I think that we don't, is that to the Middle Eastern community, I don't think they would have questioned. They wouldn't have asked why, okay? Because it was used so much. And they knew that that what was burned on the altar, God told us that it was there for a fragrant, pleasing, sweet aroma. What do they associate with pleasing, nice, fragrant aromas? Oils. And what was the most expensive oil? The best that you could give to God was the frankincense. So I don't think it was a question to them. I think they just understood it. And you know, our prayers, like the smoke, rise up to Yehovah as a sweet smelling aroma. So the frankincense provided that aroma and that connected with them on a physical level. Okay, we also read that salt, this is interesting, was added to the dough. We actually read that it was to be added to every type of grain offering. We're going to see more grain offerings as we go through here. But every grain offering, it had to have salt. Yet we find that honey and yeast were prohibited, right? So what I want to do in the next couple of minutes here, I want to talk about those three things. I want to talk about the salt and the honey and the yeast a little bit and kind of dig into that so we don't misunderstand these symbols and why they are or are not in there. Let's start with the salt. I did some reading on this. The use of salt had both practical and spiritual implications. Going back to Genesis, we find salt as part of a covenant-making ceremony. Okay, this is what they did. Think about it. Salt adds flavor, right? So that speaks to the goodness. It speaks to the benefits of the covenant, right? Because salt adds flavor. Salt adds, right? So the salt speaks to that goodness of the covenant. Okay. And so it was always part of the covenant to represent those benefits. Now, interestingly, if the covenant was broken, the offended party was then able to take large quantities of salt go to the man's fields and cover his fields with salt as punishment for breaking the covenant. How many know that if you put salt on the ground, it completely kills the ground? No vegetation can grow. You know, it's one of the primary ingredients in things like Roundup. It's glyphosate. It's salt. Okay. When I put all those rocks along the driveway at the other house, I went and bought a whole bunch of salt, and I just used a drop spreader, and I spread salt all the way down through there so that nothing would grow under them. Anyway, so you see, the salt had showed the benefits of the covenant as long as you're in the covenant, but then it also, if you break the covenant, this is the consequence, right? So when we draw this analogy to the covenant that God makes with us, the covenant he makes with us is for what? For life. Right? That's the great benefit. That's the salt. That's the goodness of life. But yet, if the covenant is broken, what is there? Is death. Right? And so the salt is what goes out on the field and it kills. We're gonna draw some more to that here in a little bit. But this is why we read in verse 13 that you are to season every grain offering with salt. Actually, we're told that all sacrificial offerings were to be salted. And in fact, the Hebrew phrase for salt of the covenant is this. It's melach beret Elohika. Definitely not pronounced right. But melach is salt, berek is covenant, salt, covenant, and then Elokia is a form of the word Elohim. So it is salt, covenant, Elohim, right? So it's a Hebrew expression, and it refers to the binding or the covenant that we make with God. One that has great benefits and also has consequences when broken. And the salt represents both of those things. The allegorical uses of salt that I have heard in so many sermons over the years, they don't carry this meaning. They don't look at the Hebrew and what the Hebrew is talking about here. We need to be careful when we use analogies that the Bible doesn't use. We simply need to take this statement in Leviticus at face value, that God employs this ancient custom to help his people Israel understand the binding nature of his covenant with them, and also make it clear that there is a consequence to breaking it, and that salt in these sacrifices are not optional. That from God's point of view, which is the same one that we should be concerning ourselves with, that this is a sign that the worshiper agrees with God and is willing and desires and intends to uphold the covenant. And the illustration holds true. As we read later in the Bible, all the way to the back of the book, right? To the end. It's meant to be taken as an indication of a permanent and sacred covenant to which you agree to adhere. And it's used to indicate breaking that covenant, referencing salt then as becoming waste, right? It's been used up. It didn't serve any more purpose now, because it's creating death. Yeshua described this in Matthew 5. You've read this before. Now read it with new eyes. You are the salt of the earth. You are the ones in covenant. You are the ones that are receiving the benefit. But if the salt loses its flavor, if it breaks the covenant, then where's the benefit? How should it be seasoned? What's it good for then, he says? It's then good for nothing but to be thrown out and trampled underfoot by men. What was Yeshua referring to? He's referring to the salt in these sacrificial offerings. And it was used for all the offerings. Got a little bit ahead of myself here, but let me just, maybe this will help. Remember that there was no blood to be put on, burned on the altar. The animals were to be drained, right? Okay. Salt is a great absorber. It absorbs, right? Now, they had all of this blood. You can drain an animal of its blood, but then the meat is still so bloody, right? I mean, the you go to the store and you buy the little package, it's got that mat under it. It's to soak up the blood. And you know, you might take a towel, paper towel, and blot it before you cook it. Well, they didn't have Bounty towels, right? So what they did is they had large amounts of salt there at the altar, and when they would take the meat, they would pack it with salt, and then they would kind of scrape that off in a pile, and then they would put that on the altar. And so this salt, then, once it was all blood soaked, what was it good for? You know what they used it for? They used it like we use gravel. They made roads out of it. They made walkways out of it. Now read the verse. Read what he's saying. He says, you're that salt. You're the benefit. You are the ones that are to take the benefit of this and reflect it out. But if you break the covenant, then the salt is nothing but waste. There is no life now. And it's just to be thrown out, just like they did, and trampled underfoot by men in roads and walkways. Right? That makes sense? You see how the salt, again, that picture of the salt in the covenant stopping the ground from, you know, that's why they and then great work great for roads, because then the weeds and stuff wouldn't grow up in the roads and the sidewalks and the walkways either, right? So, but it stopped the life. When you stop the covenant, you stop the life. Yeshua, I think here, definitely was speaking directly to the salt of the sacrifices that we're reading about. All right, let's talk about the leaven, the yeast. Now, I know we've talked about this quite a bit. We do it probably every year, a couple of times at the feast times. And many times, leaven represents sin in the Bible, but you got to understand, not all the time. The use of leaven in the Bible is really all over the map. Leaven cannot be used in sacrifices that are burned up. But it is, interestingly, used in other kinds of religious ceremonies. In fact, the 12 loaves of showbread inside the holy place. So we're not to have any leaven burned on the brazen altar because it's not holy, right? It represents sin. But then you have leaven coming into the holy place in the showbread. What's the difference? Why? Why was it acceptable in those loaves? It's acceptable in the Hebrews could cook with it, they could bake with it, they could do all sorts of things. I think the answer comes you can't understand leaven. You can't understand all of these things until you accept what leaven is and what leaven is not. Leaven is a living organism. The Hebrew word for leaven in the Bible, it's not all about puffing up. There's a lot of things that puff up. It does puff up. Our nature puffs us up. Oh yeah, that's fine. But that's not what leaven is. The Hebrew word for leaven is referring to this living organism. It's an organism that feeds on sugar. It feeds on the sweetness of the covenant. It feeds on the sweetness of God's ways. It feeds on the sweetness of God's vision and what He has for His kingdom. It feeds on that. It takes and then it produces this gas. I've talked about this before. And what's that do? It pollutes. It pollutes that which God has designed and created as a way of life for us. It's a pollutant. It's a living organism that pollutes. It's a direct reference and representation of the outside living demonic realm that comes into, feeds on what God has created and pollutes it. And that's how you have to understand leaven. And we know that God is allowing this for a season, isn't He? He's allowing Satan and this realm to influence this, for this to happen right now, so that we have to come against that influence. And so, when you think about the showbread, what did the showbread represent? It represented how God sustained them in the wilderness. Okay? So they were in the wilderness. They were in that they were dwelling in this world that was tainted by Satan. They just come out of Egypt. They had all of these things that they then we still do, that we need to purge from our lives, all this demonic influence. But God sustained them in that state of being leavened. You get that? And so that showbread then represented that God's willingness to sustain them even within their sinful nature state. And so it was appropriate to be in the holy place because it represented what God had done for them. However, notice that leaven did not go onto the brazen altar. Because if it goes on the brazen altar, what happens? What is happening on the brazen altar? We're making a smoke to rise up to a holy God. Are we to have that leaven, that organism that pollutes, go to a holy God? Of course not. He is pure. He is holy. He is not to have that. We are not to bring that into His presence. Yehovah remains pure, holy, and undefiled. So there can be no yeast in the smoke that goes up to God. Yet, when that showbread comes in there and represents what it represents, did that get burned up to God? No. It was eaten by the priests. Big difference. And so that's why I'm saying you can understand these distinctions in the Bible of when yeast is used and how it's used and how it's represented only when you come to grips with what yeast is. That's the only time that it makes any sense. Okay. How about the honey? So we're not supposed to put any honey in the bread. Well, you look that up, and it's not really honey. This word that is translated to honey can mean honey. It can. But it really can mean anything that sweetens. It can mean fruit nectars, most commonly in their area and what they used for sweetener was dates. So it was, I don't know if you juice a date or squeeze a date or whatever to get the sweetener out of it, but that's really what it was. It was date sugar. And so we kind of get an inclination of this when we look at the story of Samson. Remember, he found honey in the bones of a dead lion, and it was just like a great thing. And that's kind of what it was like. If you know, honey was something that you happened upon. It was like luck of the draw. They didn't have beehives. They didn't have beekeepers to make the honey. You found it in the rocks or in a tree or something, or even in the carcass of a dead animal. You know, the bees would make a home there. So, you know, and if you happened to find some, it was a pretty cool deal. So when you see this word honey in the Bible, don't get hung up on thinking that it was honey from trees and get a picture of Pooh Bear in his little pot, because it's not necessarily what it's referring to. Except in the rarest of incidences, this word, and it's devesh, D-E-V-A-S-H, is the word that is translated many times to honey. So the question then is, having said that, if the benefit of the covenant is sweet, why not put sweetness in it? And it's a question that the Bible doesn't really answer, at least that I could find. So I'm going to go out on a limb, and I'm going to give you my two possibles, and we'll circle up. First of all, I think, you know, the salt is already there. The salt is there representing the benefits, the sweetness, if you will, of the covenant. And so nothing else was needed. And so maybe, and I'm going to say maybe, I capitalized it in my notes, maybe Yehovah sees us adding sweeteners as us trying to add something to the covenant. You see, we don't bring anything to the table with the covenant. We respond to the covenant. We participate in the covenant. We're joyous in the covenant. We have works to do within the covenant to obey him and blah, blah, blah. But we don't bring anything to that covenant, do we? God, while we were yet sinners, he comes and he, right? So we don't bring anything initially. The only thing we bring is our corrupted, sinful, pathetic, whatever. Okay? We don't add anything to that covenant in terms of sweetness. Does that make sense? That's kind of what I thought of, you know, initially. Secondly, I read from this rabbi Maimonides. I've heard it pronounced different ways. And I think his answer holds a little bit of water, and that was that it was very common in the false religions of the day, all of the nations around them. Their gods demanded honey, H-O-N-E-Y, honey. Honey was very rare because you just, like I say, you just happened across it. So in their sacrifices, these false gods supposedly demanded actual honey. And so he says, and I think it's not outside the realm of possibility that God is once again dividing. And he's making a division between the way the other nations do things and the way that they are to do things. And so there's many other examples like that. You know, they would cut symbols in their hair you know, in their beard, you know, where it says you're not supposed to cut your beard. It doesn't mean you're supposed to let your hair grow, your beard grow forever. It just means you're not supposed to cut pagan symbols in your beard, right? So God said, don't do that. Don't do like they do. And so I think, you know, and he thinks that maybe this is another example of that. And I think maybe it's maybe true. Whether either one of those are true, I don't know. But, you know, we'll see. So to summarize, honey and leaven are not suitable by God's command for use on the sacrificial altar. Those are prohibited for the reasons I've given. We don't want those things winding up in the smoke that elevates to the Father. Okay. But those things are suitable for things that are set before God. So there's your distinction. The things on the altar rise to God. There are things like the showbread that are set before God as memorial. Okay? And so that's your distinction. Because in many of those cases, those things were eaten or used by the priests or by the priests and the one offering the sacrifice, they would share it. Okay. So the ritual of the minka kind of went like this. First, the worshiper would prepare the dough, and then they either cooked it or left it uncooked. The product was then brought to the tabernacle, later onto the temple, and it was handed to the attending priest, and the priest would then would take a handful and put it on the brazen altar, where it would be consumed with the fire. Now that handful, which we get right here, this word is kometz, K-O-M-E-T-S. And not only is it the sense of the word that it was a small portion, but it was a very small portion. So it was just a token amount, right? Now you gotta remember that. And then the remainder of that grain offering was given to the priests, and they were to use it as food. However, they were required to eat it in the tabernacle, in the courtyard, or later in the temple. That's because it was considered a sacred meal. Remember, I highlighted that when we went through there, and I said it was kodesh, it was holy. So in essence, they perceive this as dining in God's presence. And verse 3 says that the portion was given to Aaron and his sons is a most holy, kodesh portion. So that little portion, that tiny little bit that was put on the altar, had the symbolic power, if you will, to turn that the remainder large clump of dough also into holy dough. Okay? So that little piece, now think about it, you gotta stay with me. We're gonna read Paul here in a minute. That little tiny piece was put on the altar, but then all the rest of it that the priest ate was kodesh. It was holy. Okay, Romans 11. For if the first fruit is holy, the lump is also holy. And if the root is holy, so are the branches. So the first part of this, can you see how Paul, a proficient rabbi that had all of this memorized, is referring to the grain offering, to the minka? If the little bit taken off is holy, then the rest of the lump is holy as well. Those that Paul was speaking to just understood this. They would have known precisely what Paul was referring to with the grain offering. That tiny little portion of dough on the altar transmitted its holiness to the whole lump. So you see, this is why, once again, you cannot understand the back of that book without understanding the front of the book. Without understanding Leviticus, how could we possibly have the exact perspective that Paul had when he was writing this and referring to it? Okay? All right, back to Leviticus. In verse 14 here, we're given a special use of the minka. It was to be used during the feasts. But there's an interesting differential here. When the grain offering was for the purpose of a first fruit celebration, it was not done in combination with the olah. It wasn't done in the pairs. It was separate. Okay? The reason for the grain offering this way as a first fruit was to commemorate the grain harvest. And it was standalone, and it was not done, was not coupled with the olah. And in this case, instead of the grain, instead of the semolina being stripped out of the grain, ground into flour and everything, made into a dough, the grains were simply fire roasted as full heads, as it says here. The roasted whole grains then had olive oil and frankincense, again, poured on it, and it was presented to the priest, who took a small amount, once again, put it on the altar. And as we go through the holy days, of course, we've talked at length about first fruits, and I'm not going to take the time to go through all that today. But what we really want to focus on is the meaning and the purpose of the minka, the grain offering. Okay? I'm kind of going to try to bring this around full circle. What is it? The most direct thing that we have is expressed in verse 2, that it is a sweet or fragrant aroma for Yehovah. So there is a direct link between the olah, the burnt offering of an animal, and the minka, the burnt offering of grain. And so much of all of this is expressed as being pleasurable to Yehovah, and the pleasure resides in the fragrant aroma, these prayers. And so we've seen that the minka is a gift. It's along the lines of a tribute to a king. And it's supposed to bring pleasure to God. And it carries the idea of the worshiper pledging and declaring his allegiance to Yehovah and his covenant. So now, when we stand back, we've gone in and we've looked at some of these finer points. We stand back and look at this from a broader view, remembering what we covered in chapter 1, we can see a pattern emerging here. The olah was designed to gain God's attention, remember? It was in order for him to look favorably upon the one, on the worshiper. Okay? We talked about the olah maintaining peace, bridging that gap between the worshiper and Yehovah. It's an admission of the worshiper of his state, of his corrupt nature, and his need for reconciliation. And so then once that is accomplished, and that divide is healed, so to speak, then you have the minka, which is, again, like these prayers going up to the Father, right? It expresses thankfulness for his provision and all of that. So I kind of think of it like the burnt offering opens up peace and breaks down the barrier of sin between man and God. And then the grain offering is then man sending the smoke of prayers up through. Now it can get there, right? Because of the olah. So that when we look at this general concept of forgiveness, now, and I want you guys to hear me. I might go a couple minutes long, but this is really, it's all leading up to this. This is really important. When you look at this concept of forgiveness of sin by means of Yeshua's sacrificial death on the stake, We often get these confusing theological debates on sin and forgiveness, and it brings up questions like, well, if Christ died once and for all for sin, why does the model prayer that Yeshua gave us tell us to ask forgiveness? Because if everything is already forgiven, if all sin is already forgiven, why are we commanded to ask for forgiveness each time? That doesn't seem right. If the trespasses are already forgiven, why are we asking? Okay? Or questions like, if Christ died for all sin, then why am I still sinning? And if I'm still sinning, doesn't that mean that I'm not saved? All these kind of questions. So once we become Christ, we are a new creation. The Bible tells us that. We are begotten of God. Listen to me. All sin, past, present, and future, are covered. They're covered. We are redeemed to be without sin. Yet we do sin. And it's this conundrum that Satan uses up one side, down the other, to make us question our relationship with God. How can I be saved if I keep on sinning? Or if I have the Holy Spirit, then I shouldn't sin, right? So every time you do sin, Satan's there to point it out. Because the fact is that we are born into corruption. We can will with our minds not to sin. We come into agreement against sin. But then our nature overrides it. Paul referred to it this way, and I know you've read it many times before, but I'm going to read it to you again. I want you to listen to it. For I know that in me, that is in my flesh, nothing good dwells. For to will is present with me, but how to perform what is good I do not find. For the good that I will to do, I do not do. But the evil I will not do, that I practice. Now if I do what I will not to do, it's no longer I who do it. It's the sin that dwells in me. I find then a law, a reality, that evil is present within me. The one who wills to do good. For I delight in the law of God according to the inward man, but I see another law in my members, warring against the situation of my mind and bringing me into captivity to the circumstance of sin which is in my members. I'm a wretched man. How can I be delivered from this situation, from this conundrum? He says, well, I thank God, because it's Yeshua HaMashiach, our Lord, that will do that. So then, with the mind, I myself serve the law of God, but with the flesh, the law of sin. So using Paul's words translated to English here, he's drawing a separation between what his mind acknowledges as right, being in conflict with a fallen nature that's still in him. And then he's looking to the future, to Yeshua, where he'll finally be delivered from that nature. We understand that to be the Day of Atonement. But now I want you to consider something that really healed another part of my heart this week. Consider that Paul is actually highlighting the Olah and the Minka sacrifices. The concept of this strange conundrum that man lives out is introduced right here in Leviticus. Because you see, the Olah, the burnt offering, atones for an inherent corruption within mankind that causes this tension between man and God. And by having that done, it allows the minka grain offerings that aroma of prayer to then make it to the Father. Understand something. It's a great revelation here if you'll get it. Neither one of these sacrifices had anything to do for atonement of sin. Neither one of them. These two offerings are not designed to atone for committing any violation of God's law of any kind. We'll get to that later. Rather, these are dealing with man's nature, with man's corrupted spirit, and making Yehovah available to a fallen man. So far in this Levitical sacrificial system, we have not encountered a sacrifice that is even meant to deal with anyone's behavior. Has nothing to do with behavior, with anyone's disobedience to Yehovah's laws. These sacrifices are purely about God's justice system dealing with our very nature, which is not reflected in our behavior per se, but rather the state of our spirit, which, until Christ accomplished his work, could be only one condition: corrupted. So we have a sacrificial system being demonstrated by which there are two issues concerning sin and atonement that must be dealt with. One is our acceptability to God. Our acceptability, the nature that is contained in our spirits. That's one. Two is our trespasses. Then it's our trespasses, our sinful acts of lawlessness against God. They are two different things, and they get intermingled and intermeshed by the God of this world, small g, to confuse. When Messiah died, first and foremost, his sacrifice accomplished in a very grand way and complete manner the purpose of the Olah and the Minka sacrifices. His death, our faith in him, made us acceptable to God. It addressed the sinful nature apart from our behavior. His death allows us, sinful, corrupt beings, to approach a holy God. And that status remains even with sin. That status remains. So long as our behavior does not reflect a heart that fully rejects him and his son and, you know, disparages him and all of that. Because I'm not to say, and you'd never hear me say this, that obedience doesn't matter, that our behavior doesn't matter. I'd never say that. You know that. The Bible doesn't say that. God observes our behavior. Obedience does matter. God is cognizant of our obedience or lack thereof. And so, when we misbehave, Yeshua said, come and ask forgiveness. Two separate things. That's why you can still come to ask forgiveness. Remember that he's talking to people, about people that have already had this sacrifice done on their behalf. They've already been made acceptable to God. And so he says, to them that have been made acceptable to God, when you sin, come and ask for forgiveness. Confess those sins and God the Father will be quick to forgive you, my precious, acceptable child. This is why he tells us to ask forgiveness, our poor behavior, but not for forgiveness for our corrupted nature. It's already done. Therefore, one could rightly say that the shadow and the type of this particular aspect of God's justice system, what I just described, is given to us right here in Leviticus chapters 1 and 2. Amen?
Amen.
Amen.